affairs programs that make a difference.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And this is just a short note to the person who's in charge of the house at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. Last Thursday, I was in row B, seat 6, if I remember correctly. I was there to see the new production of Medea, starring Fiona Shaw, directed by Deborah Warner. Now, it's a great seat, B6, close enough to get splattered by the sweat and the spit of the action. At least it was a great seat, which is why I'm writing this note to the theater. I think it's broken now. There's something about watching the fury of a man and a woman tear each other apart emotionally that presses you back into the seat, but there's something about that moment when a mother kills her two children that caused my seat to crack. I don't think I'm alone. This production of Medea has been praised as putting new flesh and a whole lot of new blood into Euripides' 2,500-year-old play. So, Connection listeners, does Greek tragedy say things that contemporary theater cannot? Do characters like Medea still speak to us? And when she kills, is it utter madness or is it something actually possible by a woman so spurned? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. And the director, Deborah Warner, the actor, Fiona Shaw, are with me in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I have to tell you, after that Thursday night, I had an occasion to be downtown the next night. I was walking past the theater, minding my own business, and I looked across at the Wilbur and I thought, oh my God, she's in there again, doing it all over again. It must be an exhausting performance for you.
It is. It's very tiring in that I spend the rest of the time trying to rest in between these bouts of murdering activities. But it's terribly rewarding, particularly in Boston, because the audience are absolutely spectacular. It's been fantastic.
Now, Deborah, do you share some of this agony? Do you, or were you somewhere in another row of that same theater on that same night? Or are you backstage for most performances?
No, I try and avoid the backstage. There's no place for me there. But I tend to be found in the audience. Yeah, it's very interesting to have a chance to have a piece of work run for this length of time. And of course, it changes and it changes and it changes. And one wants to catch the good of those changes. So I try and watch it as much as I can.
Quick recap of the story for those who don't know Mr. Euripides' play. Medea is...
I suppose Medea is your eye. Medea is a woman who's married a hero and she wants to settle down, and they have moved to a country that neither of them belong to. And they are settled down, except that he hasn't quite settled and he's just going to marry the local daughter of the mayor or the king, and so he's left her. And so she's left without a home because she doesn't belong there. And they try to kick her out of the town. And so she is, her back is against the wall. She's got nowhere to go. But it's really the story of the fact that she loved this guy so much in the past that she did everything for him. She killed her brother. She left her father. And so she finds that there's nothing for her to do to stay united to her husband except to take her revenge in whatever way she can, which is to destroy both their lives by killing their children. That's it in essence. It's much more wiggly-woggly than that, but that's what happens. And he comes back to visit her, the husband, and he quarrels with her and says he's doing a good thing for the family. And she really, it's the story of the fact that there's a massive conflict between someone who says that they're in love and someone who says we must be practical about our marriage.
Why did you choose it, Deborah? What was it about the translation that you got your hands on, some time ago now?
About 2.5 years ago, we were invited to go to Dublin to the Abbey Theatre, and we were trying to make a choice as to what to do, and I read this particular translation in an airport, and I think what was so extraordinarily arresting about it was that the three central scenes, Jason and Medea, in this translation, which is true to the original as far as I can tell, I don't speak ancient Greek, but I know these scholars who worked on it do, is that they read really like scenes from modern American drama. So it's a much, much closer to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf than or Streetcar than almost anything else. And I think that was terribly disarming and very, very attractive. And of course, I thought, well, we better dig deeper into this story that I hadn't particularly wanted to tell. I mean, you know, this play is famous for being the most awful of revenge dramas, which, you know, in essence isn't an interesting subject. I'm not interested in offering revenge as a thing. But, of course, you know, the opposite is perhaps where the truth is revealed. And as Fiona's hinted there, you know, this is a love story, and that's why it's interesting.
Now, was that a discovery that had to strip away a lot of the theatrical baggage of what Medea was thought to be, to go to the idea of the love story rather than this just catalogue of craziness?
Yeah, of course. And you know, perhaps in some ways the older the play, the bigger the amount of barnacles on the surface of it that you have to, you know, hack off to excavate and find out what it is that's been lying at the bottom of the sea. And it took a lot of excavating, I think, to get out of its performance history.
Yeah, the craziness that we associate with anybody who might kill their children is absolutely right, because craziness is that behaviour that we find absolutely incomprehensible. But when we started rehearsing, we had a great time looking into the craziness of ordinary people in relation to sexual jealousy particularly, which is the thing that seems to absolutely hit some central part of the nervous system in the brain and make people do things they've never done. But in England, there were some wonderful cases of, there was one woman whose husband had left her, and he had a wine collection. And so she delivered, you know, two bottles of wine to all her neighbours in their milk tray in the morning. And, you know, people who obviously cut their husband's suits in half, or people who'd burnt the beds. Or there was a wonderful case I read about a man in America who, when the judge said they must half all their worldly goods, he got up on the roof with a chainsaw and half the house. I mean, the people do go demented at that moment when they feel that they have given their hearts and their life to someone else, and that person is pulling away.
So was there an aha moment for either one of you when in looking at the script, in rehearsing it, in figuring out how you're going to do it, that you realize it's not about the children? It's about the mum and dad.
It's domestic life is fascinating, isn't it? Because we knew it was going to be, it's a domestic play. It's set in their house. And the moment you have the accoutrements of a house, you know, children's toys, a pool, a bit of a house, you have people going crazy in kitchens, which they do, don't they, with, you know, carving knives or radios being put up, blaring out too loud. So actually all the tools of lunacy are around us all the time. And I think we did feel quite a ha-ha about it when you realise that the preoccupation of Medea is not the children. She adores them. The preoccupation is him. And I think he feels the same about her, that they are up there, what's called narcissistic parents. They are obsessed with each other. And it may then bump into a much wider thing that I never thought of before, which is that we assume, because we are sentimental creatures in the West, that children are the basis of family life. In fact, adult passion is probably the basis of family life, and children are often the byproduct of that passion. They're not necessarily the focus of it.
It's your husband in the play, Jason, who keeps saying, my children, and it's not out of love that he says it, but out of possession, isn't it?
Yes, as many parents do, and he hopes they'll grow up and reflect something wonderful of him back to, you know, and she also says she had sweet hopes for them to look after her when she was old. People are obsessed with children being their future investment, and that's not an unnatural thing. I don't think Euripides is trying to judge that. He's just saying, this is where the danger lies.
Now, Euripides himself, I don't know how far back you went, Deborah, but he's the person who we have on contract as our Greek tragic advisor for The Connection, tells us that Euripides was a little bit of a maverick himself, that he didn't conform to the Greek tragic notions that the characters must be good and careful and proprietous and he kind of played at the margins himself.
Yeah, I mean, it is often said that he's more Shakespearean than his contemporaries, as it were. And I think he was very, very exquisitely detailed in his psychological portraits. I did a production of Electra with Fiona 10 years ago, but we took the Sophocles version for various reasons. But when you look at Euripides' version of Electra, there's wonderful detail of everyday life and detail of, you know, what fruit she's playing with or picking off bushes when her mother comes to visit. I mean, very, very careful detail. What, of course, we don't have is another Medea play to compare with this one, so we don't know the great brave differences he made. But I suspect, of course, that he made different what we have discovered, which is that it is an entirely sympathetic examination of this character. I mean, he does not judge her.
And secular. I mean, that you know, the obsession with the gods is that you get a real feeling that Euripides, which is, to your eye, a name from the ancient Greek, is a man who absolutely wasn't sure whether God really did exist, or the gods, very like Shakespeare.
So he tacks on an ending in his play where Medea is whisked away in the chariot, and you've taken that away.
Well, I'm not sure it was ever there, because, of course, you know, it's only in the words that are spoken at that moment. It's a you know, stage direction to say, you know, a chariot descends from the heaven. I mean, you know, the Greeks didn't have dragon-drawn chariots any more than us, although, as Fiona brilliantly was saying the other day, you know, we do have dragon-borne chariots now, rather more than they did. We have these very large creatures that fly in the air carrying 500 people backwards and forwards across the Atlantic. But we haven't changed the end. We've been true, I think, to, you know, what we discovered the play to do. There's no way that she could be taken away at the end and saved. She's killed herself by killing the children, and she's stuck where she is forever. She speaks about being untouchable. She doesn't say I'm in a chariot, but she says I'm beyond my enemies. I'm above you now. You can't touch me. And indeed, Jason doesn't kill her at the end. And I think that's the most extraordinary thing. And he doesn't do it, I think, because there's nothing left to kill. She's hollow.
Is there something in Greek tragedy that works particularly well now, either in the simplicity of the story or the density of the emotions that
I think you mentioned in your introduction that, you know, whether are Greek tragedies more pertinent than modern drama. I think part of the shock of the play is that the audiences or readers are shocked at how incredibly immediate the writing is, because we have all suffered from education systems that have made this something to do with third level education and not actually the stories of family lives at their worst. And I think that I also think that the Greeks were onto something about the mapping of the human emotions in contradiction with human intellect. So the human intellect was incredibly active at that moment, and they were inventing science and atoms and the rest of it. And they were actually at odds with the fact that their feelings were doing something else. And we as a generation are particularly bad at acknowledging that. We think human science is going to save us. Nothing will save us from these feelings. We have them, and we have to find them. I mean, there's political overtones to it. The fact that no amount of UN activity or debating activity stops wars. It's something. We are mainly animals and just barely civilized. And I think they were much more honest about that than we are.
That's a scary view of the world. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. The production of Medea that we're talking about is Broadway bound, and that's a real mark of credit to it. The lead actor, Fiona Shaw, and Deborah Warner, the director, who are with me in the studio. We invite your calls at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying, and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Deborah Warner, director of a new production of Medea, which is currently playing in Boston. And Fiona Shaw is with me as well. She plays Medea. And thought we could perhaps start with a sense of what happens on the stage. Deborah, do you want to set up a little performance for us?
A little live performance from the studio.
Can we?
Yes, that would be lovely. I think one of the things that is so extraordinary about this play is that on page 3 of our text, Medea says, "I'm going to kill the children." And on page 43, nearly one page from the end, and an hour and 20 minutes later, that is the thing that she does. But of course, her early threat and the conclusion have no direct connection to each other. She says, "I'm going to kill the children," in the way that one might, in an argument at home, say, "I'm going to kill him." You know, we don't mean it, and she doesn't mean it. And the tragedy of the play is that events become so snarled and mangled and run ahead of her that in the end she has no choice but to kill the children. And this is a very, very complicated thing. And during our rehearsal period, I saw an extraordinary photograph of a German Hausfrau at the end of the Second World War standing with two little shrouds at her feet. And the caption of the photo is that she had just killed her 8-year-old and 10-year-old son because she'd heard that Germany had lost the war. And she thought that hands more savage than her own would kill them if she didn't kill them first. So I think this is a way into Medea's final speech in the play before she kills the children.
"What's next, my friends, is clear. I must kill the children quickly and be gone. Yes, quickly. Delay will yield my sons to hands more savage than my own. Necessity is their judge. They die. I gave them life, and now I give them death. My heart, all dagger, is do it. Dare, don't flinch. Come hand, come sword, this course must be run. No weakness, no. Memories, flesh of your flesh, just forget you love them. For one short day, forget. Then weep, wretch, weep, who killed to prove her love."
Fiona Shaw from the new production of Medea, currently playing in Boston. Your delivery of that is extraordinary. I find I get the same chills I got when I watched you on stage just listening to you here. It's a nice piece of writing to work with, though, isn't it? I mean, there's something...
It's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's that halfway through a thought, the person changes their mind, which is, I think, how we experience a lot of our lives, that we don't intend to do things in one big, walloping surety. We contradict ourselves all the time. And as soon as you think you can do something... I was always very moved by Mary Queen of Scots, you know, who wanted to die so well. And when she got down to have her head chopped off, she collapsed. Her legs just went from under her, even though her intention was to be brave. Sometimes our bodies or our spirits or our memories or our loves are at odds with our desire.
And we don't know. I'm guessing here, but we don't know because you're not supposed to know the moment at which you make that decision, "I'm going to do it," because it builds and it ebbs and then it comes back, and there's no point at which we go, "Aha, that was that thing that Jason said to her, that's what pushed her over." I don't know, maybe I'm reading things into it, but we're allowed to do that as audience, aren't we?
I think what pushes her into it is something very particular, because she does have a little revenge. I mean, she sends a little incendiary device in a box up to the palace and in the process kills the princess, the lady that that Jason is about to marry. But in fact, of course, this tiny little incendiary device does something so much bigger than intended. It wipes out an entire history. It wipes out, I think, the whole of Corinth. It has a size. It's Hiroshima. It's something so much bigger than anybody thought they were doing at that moment. Mm-hmm. And so when the messenger comes, and there's an extraordinary 3-page speech at the end of the play, and I never really understood why this speech was written at such extraordinary length. But of course, it is during that speech, when Medea is entirely silent, just hearing the terrible damage done, that she knows that she must kill the children. So, in fact, the final decision is done off the text.
Mm.
You didn't know that before, did you, Fiona?
No, I didn't. Actually, I was thinking that it's something to do with also this thing about being Greek rather than Christian, that it's not that she plans a thing and then decides to do it and does it and commits a sin. It is that the action itself is slightly an interplay between her and a sort of the way in which one cooks, does any amount of damage, that when one decides to do something, you have to be careful of what it is you decide to do because it will happen.
And you must be very careful of the language you use. Mm. If you use the language of threat, I'm going to kill him, I'm going to kill her, I'm going to kill the children, it's just possible, of course, that may come true.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to Charleston, South Carolina. Jenny's joining us. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Uh-huh. I reread Medea a number of years ago when Susan Smith killed her two children in South Carolina. And I remember mentioning it to people and wanting to get a conversation going about it, but nobody reads it anymore, so very few people had read it. And those that had thought it was just another horrible instance of something. And then again, when Andrea Yates in Texas killed her children, I found that it's just so abhorrent. People really don't want to talk about it. It's really horrible. But what I noticed was that in contemporary life, the women who have killed their children in recent years are essentially pathetic, depressed, terribly troubled, and their action seems to come out of this sense of hopelessness. The people who kill their children with rage, as in Medea, in contemporary life, are the men who kill wives or ex-wives or women from whom they're separated and often kill the children and then kill themselves. What I am fascinated with is the presence in Medea of rage. And my feeling is that it is the rage that she chooses to claim and act out of that is so transgressive, that when women get angry, people want to clear the room because it is that that terrifies. Killing the children in the case of Andrea Yates and Susan Smith was horrific and depressing, and they seem to be terribly depressed and troubled people, but they don't seem to be
angry.
Let
me just interrupt, if I can, for half a second here, Jenny. Do we make a split here in your view, Fiona, Deborah, between the maleness of the rage act, the sort of more...
But Medea in our production does not kill the children from rage.
By the time you meet the moment of the killing, she is beyond rage, and I think theatrically that has to be the case. I mean, the terrible Smith killings and the any biographical associations of these unfortunate events all have a story. And the very good thing about any Greek tragedy is they can allow one to be compassionate, at least, about the peculiarities of each person's story when these unfortunate events happen. But Medea is about something much wider, which is that we, in order to stay sane, may need to look at our reasonable excesses. And if you don't believe that Medea, who has rage, she's full of rage at the beginning, but she's quite calm at the moment of choosing this death. That's why it is interesting to an audience. If it was just rage, then it is madness. Rage is a kind of out-of-your-brainness. And that wouldn't be of any use, no more than Hamlet being really mad would be of use, or King Lear being really mad would be of use to us. It's this edge between the intellect and the chaos that the intellect is seeing that is the moment of extremis in humanity. That is what the theatre pushes us towards. So
but,
its function
but
is slightly
different.
What is
it that moves that action beyond the revenge, the sense of revenge, beyond the rage? So there is that sort of coldness, the clarity that you of that moment.
It's a battle, isn't it, of logic. People who have invented an entire life with somebody whose entire meaning is bound up with that person, and in the peculiarity of Medea, who has given up perhaps too much in order to be in that one place, they have nothing to lose or nothing to gain. They can't. She says, I have no home, no homeland, no resting place. I can't go backwards, I can't stay where I am, and I can't go forwards. Now, that's not usually the case with most people. That is Medea's particular case.
And the banishment in this case is pretty severe. I mean, she really is stuck without a place to go.
And that's the hardest thing to communicate now, because banishment, you know, people are refugees all over the world.
Uh-huh.
In fact, there is nowhere where she's welcome. You have to believe that. And that's a peculiarity of the turning of the screw of the story, that there is nowhere for her to go. She has already done too much damage. She has given all her heart to this person. They've created two boys who he now wants to diminish by an acquisition of two other sons, mm-hmm. which will immediately make her children less valid, as it were. These are more than enraging. They're self-immunizing. They make nonsense of the aspiration of love.
I mean, we all long to be in passionate love affairs, but actually very few of us have killed one of our family members for that place. And God knows, I'm sure there are some in the world who have. But if you have done that, and if the loved one then leaves you, you are absolutely stateless, cityless, and without your spirit. I think it's a terrible lesson in that. You know, it's not about loving too much. It's about doing something impossible for that love because there's no place of return. Jason cannot leave Medea because of what she did. And, of course, he should have weighed that at the moment. She's given everything for him.
Tell us a little bit about how it is that you choose to present these two. Again, take us back to Euripides and ahead to today, because Jason's a pretty famous guy. Medea's, I don't know what, goddaughter, granddaughter of the sun or something. She's not an insignificant character. Are these the Brad Pitt, Jennifer Aniston, Beckham and Posh Spice type famous characters of their day?
Yes, we deify people. We make them demigods, don't we? We make the significance of their lives greater than the significance of our own lives. This is what demigods are. They're people whose lives have meaning for lots of people. It's a complete myth. It's a complete invention. And maybe the consequence for those people is that they have to live very carefully because the collapse of their lives has meaning for others and, of course, it has maybe a higher destructive value for themselves. So these famous divorces are often catastrophic.
Or the death of Princess Diana. And the
completely.
Response to that is exactly the same sort of, you know, that was something everybody got to inhabit, but
absolutely, that people, you know, people find that the horrendousness of her death was somehow inevitable at the end.
And yet, Deborah, you put Fiona in kind of a faded sundress with not a very attractive sweater, jumper on, and
very attractive sunglasses.
The sunglasses are cool. I like the sunglasses.
PKMY.
Well, do you know what I mean? That you're
completely
making her much more of us than of them.
Yes. I mean, I think the story that we work very hard to tell is that Jason's leaving of this household is 3 days old. This is a very, very recent raw and open wound. Mm. I think 3 mornings ago he said, "Darling, I'm going to go and marry the princess. I'm leaving." She had no idea that this was coming. So what we meet somebody 3 days old in their grief. And I believe what she's been doing for those 3 days is probably setting fire to everything in the house and sawing beds in half and all of those things that we would understand that she'd been doing and making indecent phone calls to, you know, the president and whose daughter is marrying Jason. So I don't think she's wearing her best frock at the time. No, I think she's...
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Jenny, thanks for your call. We're switching to Providence, Rhode Island now. Nancy's on the line. Hello, Nancy.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
I teach this material in college, and there's an interesting political angle that I think is missing from the conversation, namely that Medea is a Persian woman. She's characterized as other and as a foreigner, but interestingly, from the Greek point of view, she's from the East. She's Persian. She's barbarian. And when I teach this material today, it has a lot of resonance. The last time I taught it, I had some Muslim people in the class, and the conversations were really very exciting when I brought up the fact that Medea is not simply a wronged housewife, but she's this kind of a foreigner living in the Western world.
You'll know the play better than I do, Nancy, in the way that it's written. Is she a lesser person for being from the East?
No, well, not lesser, but she's other. She is like, she encapsulates everything that is other from the Greek point of view.
And there's nothing very attractive about other?
Well, it's exotic, it is attractive, it's alluring, but it's very, very dangerous.
And it's very lonely too, Fiona.
Yes, I'm an Irish person, and I play this in London. And we're definitely the barbarians in London. So it's, I think barbarians are whoever is other and slightly exotic and slightly less civilized. And that's what we are. She, of course, in return, Medea says, you know, I have to live in this place where they have laws and ways I never knew at home. Everybody's laws seem peculiar if you're not from them. You know, you have Thanksgiving. We find that extraordinary. So,
what's this Guy Fawkes thing? No, yeah, never mind.
Exactly. All our rituals seem peculiar to the outsider. And, of course, I think that this lady who's calling in teaching it, it must be very interesting because at the moment the mapping, the geographical map, it may be very relevant to her students. However, theatrically, what is interesting for us is that these magic words like Iolcus or these places near the Barbaros or these clashing rocks, all these strange bits of Middle Eastern landscape serve really as a sort of metaphor for foreignness. They don't have to be literal to the audience. And I feel that's terribly important for us because we're playing to an audience who may not know that kind of geography and who may not know that kind of history. And I'm very keen that the audience need know neither of these things to see a play.
Nancy, do you see the character as a sympathetic character, as a victim?
As a victim, did you say?
How do you teach her?
Oh, it depends on the class. And I start out, I mean, I try to get people to see her sympathetically, but she is very, very complex. She's not entirely a sympathetic character. Some people want to see her that way. I think part of what's going on in Greek tragedy is kind of attacking different political positions from multiple perspectives, and I think it's important to get as many of those perspectives as you can by filling in historical and cultural context.
Nancy, thank you for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, and we'll come back talking more about the new production of Medea with its director, Deborah Warner, and the actor, Fiona Shaw. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from National Public Radio.
Makes me treat you the way I do. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you? There's nothing in the world too good for a guy that's good and true. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you?
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. RG.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. And with me in the studio, Deborah Warner and Fiona Shaw. We're talking about the play that is currently being produced in Boston, Medea. Some of you may know Fiona Shaw from other roles, both theater and film, like perhaps the character she played in last year's blockbuster, Harry Potter.
Oh, here he comes, the birthday boy.
Happy birthday, son.
Why don't you just cook the breakfast and try not to burn anything?
Yes, Aunt Petunia.
I want everything to be perfect for my Dudley's special day.
Oh, radio should be visual once in a while. Poor Fiona has her head in her hands as we listen to Petunia Dursley. But I'll tell you why I wanted to hear it, partly just because I think it's cool and that it's such a fantastic jump from one to the other, but also because one of the things that I thought about watching Medea is just how interesting it is that you have to play a theatrical, put together a production the way that you have in a world where film is so much a part of what our entertainment is, and that it's not a problem at all to throw a child on a broomstick and send him off chasing a golden orb, but you're doing something that's way more powerful, and you have to do it in live theater. Do you think about the pull and the push of what film can accomplish and what you can do on stage?
Every day. I know that the theatre can be the most powerful thing of all, but it isn't always. And I know that too. And I suppose one's job, my job, my daily challenge is to justify its place.
Don't justify it. Just tell me why it is the most powerful when it's at its best.
Because the audience are making it happen. So the fact of the particular night is a very, very powerful thing, is that, you know, 1,000 people listening together and reacting together can change the shape of the evening. And this can't ever happen in film because what's on the screen can't change, but Fiona can change.
Do you see it? Do you see Fiona change in response to a house, an audience, a different set?
Completely. Yes, it's in the same way as an orchestra will change given a conductor's particular feeling that night. You know, it's a very, very finely tuned thing. I think, you know, what happens perhaps why we're looking at the Greeks again is that we've always said that the theatre is a place for debate, but I'm not sure we quite understand what that means. And I think if democracies are a little bit wobbly, there's no question that theatre perhaps is going to become more and more important a place, because it is a moment where people can come together and, in the case of Greek drama, look at things that can't be looked at anywhere else. I mean, a film of Medea could be a very dark event indeed, and one in which I'm not sure that the audience would come out cleansed. I think they'd come out deeply depressed, because the act of theatre allows for catharsis, and catharsis is somewhere connected to the fact that at the end of the evening we do know that everybody's safe. It really is an issue. We know that the two children have not been killed, although we believed that they were in the playing of the play. But when those little creatures run forward in the curtain call, our clapping is a form of catharsis, because we have been taken into the absolute darkest of dark places to examine our feelings and relationship to something, but we're allowed out again, and we can perhaps talk about something that otherwise we couldn't have had a conversation about.
Yes, we're sort of like children. We have two little children, you know, who do brilliant dead acting, a thing that children don't mind doing at all, because they do it all day, every day, when they're playing cowboys. So these little boys do this, they just do flopping and they're dead. But the audience's imagination makes them dead and probably reassures themselves at the same time that's okay, they're probably alive. And sure enough, when they come out and are applauded, there is a relief, because the audience are also praising themselves, I think, for having made them dead with their minds.
It's a creative act, being in an audience. I think that's what we're saying.
You guys must have a lot of fun working together. I'm fascinated listening to the way you think together. You've done a lot together.
We have done a lot together, yeah. Yeah, we've done about five or six things together. We did Electra, Deborah referred to, and we did Hedda Gabler, which we also done at the Abbey and in London. And we've done Richard II together, and we did The Good Person, Sichuan, and we did
The Wasteland.
Wasteland. Mm. So you like working together?
Not always.
Thank you for that. 1-800-423-8255 to Boston. Sean's on the line. Hello, Sean.
Hello, Dick, Deborah, Fiona. I have a quick question for you, and it's my interpretation of Medea's brutal murder of her children. And I'm wondering, does she do it not only for revenge, but also to slow her husband, Jason, from capturing her when she escapes, like she did with her brother against her father? That makes sense at all to you?
I think so. Do you mean does she do it to keep Jason still with her?
No, she's removing everything to do with him from her life, and that this is a way of she is escaping from his life, and this is another way of her slowing him down, like her father was slowed down, right, trying to find the pieces of her brother.
Certainly, there's a fantastic theme in the play that, which is a very dubious one for all of us, which is that somehow the sins of your past start to haunt you again. So Jason, who has had no fear of his wife, when she kills the children, he starts saying, God, I should have known it. You killed your brother before. Suddenly a person's action from before becomes terribly relevant and is slightly either fair or unfair. That's between, you know, anybody's view. But she is trying to remove probably her life from... She's trying to hurt Jason, but she is also probably trying to get him back. He says, you've made yourself very unhappy. She says, your unhappiness is my comfort. I think she would prefer to be locked in an unhappy relationship with Jason than in none at all. And the problem about leaving the children alive is that he would have got used to the situation, whether she took them away or left them. And he would have neutralised Medea. She cannot be neutral in his
right.
heart. And I think that's much nearer, whether that she's trying to destroy their lives, but in destroying it, she benefits by unifying them.
And it is an act that has, in mythical terms, tied them together forever. Hasn't it? We rarely mention the word Medea without the word Jason attached, or vice versa. So, it certainly did its awful, awful, powerful, good.
What do you think, Sean?
I think that's a pretty good answer to my question and another interpretation of it. And the other quick question I had was I can't remember the director's name, but there was a movie version of this, black and white, Lars.
Pasolini.
Yes, and the reason that the conclusion I came to with that was at the very end, it's all black and white, and she shows this shocking red hair. So she has been reborn and now continues with her life as she's left her husband in utter despair.
I mean, I think many an interpretation is possible. I mean, I don't think there's anything about rebirthing that happens at the end of this. I think she's done something that absolutely destroys herself. I don't think people recover from murder.
Do you think that, based on what you've heard from people who've seen the play, that men see it differently from women?
Well, men, you know, Jason is not given equal weight in the play, except that he does make three appearances where he gives his point of view, and it's terribly important that that's a sympathetic point of view. It's not that she's some victim that is, you know, overcoming some evil husband. He has a point of view, which is that because they don't live in the place, they have no power, and he feels that if he can just have a sort of a marriage with this girl up the road, he'll be in and he can keep the whole family safe. This is probably
you believe
true.
Him when he's saying that?
I believe he believes himself to be virtuous when he says it, and I think that's where a lot of misunderstandings between all couples exist, that there's a kind of fundamental misunderstanding about what their roles are. I mean, the thing it mushrooms really into being a question about what is the contract in marriage? You know, is his job to protect the family? In which case, does he believe himself to be doing the right thing? That's between, you know, Jonathan Cake, who plays Jason, is fantastically defensive of that particular argument, that he's doing what he believes to be the right thing. It may be that Medea has a slightly bigger imagination and sees further ahead, which is that if he marries another woman, which may protect them for a while politically, fundamentally, he will never really be married to her again, and they will never really have married life again. There's only 7 days in a week.
But he's not the first nor the last that has done a split week with two families.
No. And if it had less passion in their relationship, it might have worked.
Say that again. If he'd had less passion?
If they both had. If in a way, if she could endure it, if you could say, well, do you mind that we just have a three-day-week marriage now? And that would be fine. But it's not in the nature of that kind of love.
And not in the nature of a relationship where she's sacrificed
right.
as much as she has sacrificed. And I guess in the same turning the mirror around, or at least in the way that she seemed that she sacrificed. I mean,
yes, I mean, she believes that she has done all the right things for love. Well, she's done very big things for love, and he believes he may believe that he's doing the right thing, but he's creating an illusion for himself, and she knows that.
They're both very exciting creatures, though. We mustn't forget that. They are, I think we're allowed to see that they are tremendously well matched. And I think one of the very painful things is that we somewhere would like them to continue to be together. They're sexy. They're both equally powerful in their worlds. They're both equally famous. They've both done very famous things. And
I found actually watching that part of the play when they're drawn together and their hands reach out to each other, quite. Creepy, you know, because I bought it. I believe it. I think that the emotion, you know, so to your credit, is genuine, but it's just doesn't seem right. But, you know, they're fighting. They can't hug each other and fight at the same time. You know, it's just a simplistic view.
Yes, I mean, I know recently a divorced couple who made love the night before their divorce, having not made love for a long time. People, we are peculiar creatures. I think the contradiction in our feeling is a thing that is being displayed for our judgment by Euripides. He's not judging it. He's just saying, I think we're this type of person.
When you read the script, when you read the play, you were enchanted by the power that's in that female character, Deborah. Somewhere I read that you said it was one of a dozen or so such powerful roles that existed for women. Am I mischaracterizing?
No, there aren't so many roles that exist for women. So one tends to have to look at the ones that that famously do. And I think in some way those particular roles may have got rather corrupted, because I think sometimes actresses come to them wanting to play a powerful woman. And of course, what you find out in the case of this Medea, or in the case of the Hedda Gabler I did with Fiona, that these are, you know, Hedda's mystery, and the most fascinating thing we discovered is that Hedda is a coward. It's a great play about a coward. And in that way, she's every woman. She's Hamlet, as it were. And so too with Medea, you discover somebody, in a way, rather ordinary, who ends up doing something extraordinary and becoming marked forever by that. So I think there's a terrible task in slightly releasing these from the history of people who perhaps sometimes, because actresses' lot is not always great, there's not perhaps enough for them to do, play them for the wrong desires. And thus Hedda becomes an ice maiden and a very fierce woman, or Medea.
So is that similarly, in part, the magic of the role for you, Fiona, that in this powerful character you have to express it through some form of weakness? Or
yes, it's also what's very hard about playing it, actually. It'd be much easier, much more aggrandizing to play a rather glamorous queen of a person who has a revenge against her husband, but it would be of no particular interest. I think that's it's much harder to play weakness.
I want to thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Fiona Shaw, actor, and Deborah Warner, thanks for being here. Director of Medea, the Abbey Theatre of Ireland's production of Medea is playing at the Wilbur Theatre in Boston through the 3rd of November. And then it heads to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Watch for a Broadway address in the weeks to come. Connection listeners, please feel free to go to our website. We're at theconnection.org. Share your thoughts and ideas about the play on our forum pages. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Carter Holleran and Meredith Levinson. Graham Smith is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Like a call from within, come back to me. What on earth must I do? Scream and yell till I'm blue. Curse your soul. When will you come back to me?
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.